Welcome back to Following No Adonis Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 202, and we are in chapters 5 through 9 of The Bands of Mourning. Paul, how are you?
Fantastic, yeah. Enjoying it, enjoying the chapters, excited to talk with y'all.
Elliot, how are you?
I am doing well. I'm very excited to be taking a break from all the yard work that I've been doing the last few weekends to talk with you guys about the Cosmere.
Yeah, you had some trees blow down, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a big deal. We had 6 trees blow down in a giant windstorm. So I had to buy a chainsaw.
Very nice.
That seems like a fair thing. I too am glad to talk with y'all rather than I would want to do yard work.
Battle your snakes.
Yeah. Yeah, I have found several snakes at my house in the past couple weeks. So there we go.
All right. Let's roll intro and then we'll talk about the band's morning for brand attention. All right, Elliot, does anything happen in these chapters besides a train robbery?
We ride on trains. We get attacked. We do a lot of fancy allomancy and ferrochemy, or not in some instances when you get metal cubes thrown at you, actually. And yeah. There's other stuff that I do want to talk about. There's actually a lot of interesting little bits and pieces here in these chapters, but we don't actually get super far in these chapters. We get on the train at the beginning, and I don't even know that we're fully off the train ride by the end of chapter 9.
Yeah, we get to like the town just shy of New Sarum, yeah, which is where we're going to be going. Yes, there is a lot of like 2-paragraph, 3-paragraph little details in these chapters that are kind of interesting that we don't really explore too much. Before we get to the train robbery, the train stops at a random town in the country. I don't remember what it is. And it's like early evening, and there's a protest going on the train platform. And Wax gets an egg thrown at him, and Wax is like, what on earth was that? I didn't even know there was unrest in the basin. Like, what's going on? And Steris explains to him that there is a lot of issues with how the train geography is set up, and all of the smaller towns are beginning to be more vocal on how the train network is set up. They want inter-town train routes, and Elendel is explicitly like denying them the funds to do so because they want all the goods to go through Elendel and then be redistributed taxed to fund Elendel. What do you guys think of just like this random economy little nugget in the Bands of Mourning? We had one of these in the last book, if you remember.
I actually do key into the context clues of what's going on in the bigger picture. Because, of course, we're going to learn about our characters and magic systems like we spent a while talking about last episode, last week. But even when they're just kind of giving us more information about the geopolitical landscape that we're in, I actually do like that because it helps us get a picture of what's going on off stage, you know, what's going on elsewhere on Scadrial or even maybe just in the Elendel basin. I was a little disappointed by this map in the beginning of my book. It is a very, very good map, but all these cities that are mentioned, there's not a lot, maybe 3 or 4 in this chapter. None of them are actually on this map. So I'm just kind of assuming we're somewhere here in between Elendel and New Sarum. New Sarum is on the map. So I can see where we're going. But There's just a kind of blank, mostly blank train line that runs out there. And to talk for just a brief second on the actual context we do get from these protests, I am trying to decide, because I think it was important last book, and I'm assuming it's going to be more important going forward, unless maybe this book's going to spend the entirety outside of Ellendale, which is maybe possible. I'm trying to decide whether the system, like the aristocracy, if you will, is bad or good. Do we need to be rising up against the system? That was kind of part of the question from last book. We had the constable Aridel, was that his name?
Yeah, Aridel. So can I give a little recap of what happened at the end of last book?
Yeah, please.
So the entirety of last book, Bleeder is pointing out there's some corruption in the government. There's some higher up nobles that are absolutely not doing what's best for their houses. And while the governor, he may have been elected, he's doing some shady trade deals on the back. And we need to do something about it. And at the end of last book, the governor has been dead for like half the book. And the chief of police, Aridel, is trusted by pretty much everybody, is appointed as temporary governor. And then in the epilogue, he realizes, if I step down, these crooked noble houses are going to put in place somebody that they can manipulate. And it's just going to happen again. So Aridel took on the full-time job as governor. So in this book, or in this chapter that you're talking about, Wax comments to himself, oh, maybe I should talk to Aridel about some of these inter-small town train routes that they're protesting for, because Wax just hasn't really been paying attention to all this. He's been grieving for Lessie. He's been out in the roughs before that. He's, you know, he just hasn't been really doing the politics thing. But his house has been voting to uphold these train lines that go only directly into Ellendale, because that raises the income on his textiles, I think his house makes, or pottery. I don't remember what he makes, but he's been voting in favor to keep the central trade hub of Ellendale as a thing and not inter-train between cities, and the smaller towns are upset about it. So that's where we are at the beginning of this book.
And coming from Era One, where the higher-ups were very nastily oppressing the lower class. Like we had no qualms about Kelsier's crusade to take down the nobles. Seemed like a thing that needed to happen. And the Ska were being absolutely trampled on, tortured. Yeah, not good. So on the surface, Era 2 seems a lot better. Seems like the average person has a way better life. They're not being forced slavery, labor in the field that we've seen. But I'm still kind of, you know, trying to get it together of, is the system good or is the system bad? So these kind of things that are a little bit kind of in that gray area of, should Ellendale be controlling all the trades so that they get a cut of the profits and not letting all the smaller cities do their own trade or go around them? Like, probably not. Like, are we starting to get into this? Maybe the system needs to be overthrown territory that we were kind of exposed to last book. I'm still gathering evidence.
I wanted to add, I appreciate this these chapters and these moments. And I appreciate that it's just kind of a glimpse. It serves as a glimpse. I feel like this gives us a picture of, outside of the characters we're following, just what the life looks like for the people on Skadriel. I feel like we had a really clear picture in Era One what that looks like, and Elliot was mentioning it. It was not very good. The average person, I feel like, did not have a great time. The Ska definitely did not have a good time, to my knowledge, in on Skadriel. But I feel like we have a different picture here. It's not ideal, but it's not, I guess, super oppressive. You know, it seems a bit better. But I like these chapters. I like these moments because we kind of get that image almost in passing, it feels like, in this one chapter. So I appreciated it. Long story short, I guess it didn't have any super major takeaways from it. If I did, then I'd probably miss, if I should have, then I'd probably miss something big, but
it,
yeah.
It's kind of, for me at least, it's kind of just painting the picture. Like you said, compared to Era One, this is pretty small potatoes, right? Like they're shipping their goods through Ellendale. It gets a 5% tax or whatever. But is that an issue? Yeah. I mean, is it affecting the people that are being taxed? Yeah. So no matter how good and picturesque and pleasant the Ellendale Basin may be, there's still going to be issues no matter what type of system you have. It's just kind of the scale of the issue that we're talking about. So yeah. Are they having issues with a tax on Ellendale? They're going to voice their opinion on it. So I think that's kind of an interesting dynamic. But I think this is going to set up for is our crew of five that we have, Milan, Waxen, Wayne, Steris, and Marcy. I think they may be treated a little differently outside of Ellendale. Like, they don't have any like serious enemies besides like Wax has some like nemesises in his past or whatever. But I think there's going to be some hostility specifically because they're from Ellendale when they arrive where they're going to. So I just think that's what they were trying to set up there.
Kind of related to that, Wax and Steris keep talking and they talk about a few other things, and Wax does share a little bit of his logic for what he does. The whole lawman thing we talked in the early chapters, the prologue specifically, about how maybe some of the experiences of Wax's past have shaped his drive to be the lawman and uphold the law so that nasty, terrible things don't happen to people when you don't enforce the law. And he talks a little bit about that more and gets a little bit philosophical with his line was something close to like, without law, there's no freedom, which yeah. May seem to some like a paradox. It's well, what do you mean? The law is oppressing me. But I thought he had a pretty good point where I think what he's trying to say is if there was no law, it'd be such chaos. We would impinge upon each other's freedoms, rights, whatever you want to call them, ability to exist, that you need structure to allow people to thrive. And his word is explore. Allow people to explore because you have a structure for everyone to live within, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I also caught on that to that line with without law, there's no freedom. I'm sure like that line that we had in the last book of everything is worth what its purchaser will pay for it or whatever. I'm sure there's a line from someone famous in history on Earth that has said that. I don't know what it is. Maybe I'll look it up. But without law, there's no freedom is kind of like this really deep, like, oh, yeah, I guess I never thought about it that way. But
so what you're telling me is Wax knows his Roman philosophers well and quotes them regularly.
I definitely could be a Roman proverb. I'll look it up here in a second. Is there, what's another like small detail that we got in these chapters that you guys thought was interesting?
I was very intrigued by the beast that Marcy comes across a drawing of in all the Riller. Say that name again for me so I can get to stick
Riller. Riller.
Riller.
Yeah.
Lay on the U for a while. Riller.
Riller. Yeah,
like fishing lure.
Yep. Riller. Okay. Also, I found it. It's John Locke.
Oh, hey.
There you go. 1689.
Wax is well read in his earth lore. Apparently.
Yeah.
Anyway, Relure has left them with a bunch of notes and sketches and things like this, which a lot of it is rather incomprehensible because he's missing a spike, so he's a little crazy. But Marcy is going through the notes as they're riding on the train, and she comes across this drawing of a terrible beast of some kind. And there's like notes and things that go along with it. Yeah, a lot of it's like just ramblings of a crazy lure. But the description of it is interesting, and Marcy muses on some of the same things that I am, which is it's described as having no eyes, which the notes that she's reading from some of the Chondra, there's like Chondra commentary, like Vendel or somebody as well, are wondering, like, no eyes. Could that be a spikes in the eyes? Could this be some kind of hemallergic creature? We saw some rather scary looking hemallergic creatures last book that Wax had to fight. Is this another evolution of that? Or I think Marcy wonders this herself. Is this Trell, who we've been trying to figure out who Trell is? Is this something else? What is this beast? Oh, the other bit we get before you guys weigh in, it's specifically described, I think this is Relure's notes, it is of the void.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too. This is straight up like an early Vorin description of a void bringer.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I thought. Like,
I read as well.
Red skin, eyes are super crazy, like all deformed looking. Like, this sounds like a void bringer, and it fell from the sky, according to Relure. What's going on?
It absolutely felt like that, Trevor. I had the exact same thought in my head of is this just a void bringer here on Skadril? I knew that wasn't the case. To what Elliot was saying a little bit, I took this as assuming that there were spikes in the eyes. I feel like that was the ultimate, I guess, synopsis or conclusion kind of drawn, at least in my mind, was that there were spikes in the eyes. And we've kind of been wondering where hemallergy is going to really take shape in this. We don't have Inquisitors. We do know about it with Kolos, and we do know about it with our Chondra has been the primary way that we've seen that. But we haven't really seen anyone just like our normal people really with spikes, other than, I guess, Wax's earring potentially. So anyways, kind of been waiting on that. That's kind of where I took it, my understanding.
What have we had any other mentions about the Southern Roughs or the Southern Mountains or towards New Saren up until this point?
Not that I can remember.
There was
maybe earlier on.
There was that one section of the broadsheet that I read.
Yeah.
Do you remember that, Paul?
Nice job, Elliot. Do you remember
it? All vaguely. I've been reading some of the broadsheet. I've actually been reading them more closely now that I found that one thing that was of interest before. It still seems like they're mostly irrelevant, and Brandon's just messing with me, making me read a bunch of goofy stuff to try and hunt for the relevant information. But
you don't want to learn about Allomancy insurance and how you can insure your aqueduct on your roof to
no. I want to know that exists because it's brilliant world building. I don't want to read an entire newspaper article about it. No, thanks. Sorry. I joke. It's quite a clever device, actually, even if it is tedious to read. The excerpt from, was this like first half of last book, Shadows of Self? Yes, probably.
It was broadsheet 2 of Shadows of Self.
Okay, look at that. You know, it must be important if you know that off the top of your head. The the bit of information that I plucked out of that broadsheet was like an eyewitness description of a scary dark beast that came out of a pool of water in the mountains near the Southern Roughs.
Yeah,
and I immediately keyed in on this, like, oh, okay, I know what pools of water are in the Cosmere. that must be a perpendicular, or it could be, I should say, a perpendicularity. But yeah, you asked me like, oh, what does that scary looking beast remind you of? And I think I drew that, didn't really have a good answer for you, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you are correct. That was the only reference I think you've gotten to the south of Ellendale. What's going on in the Southern Roughs? There's some like crazy fantastical eyewitness account of a pool of water and creepy eye monster coming out of pool of water. And that's it.
The other thing I'm still looking for that's, I'm sure, is outside of Ellendale Basin is Coloss and Biplanes. Still on my list.
Oh, yes. The Coloss and Biplanes. I forgot about that.
I'm really impressed, Elliot, that you got that also, because I feel like I remember you saying you really didn't, you know, kind of glossed over these, those sheets, you know, that it was less relevant. But yeah, I did not remember that at all. It's really funny listening to the audiobook because I'm like, okay, there's like, you know, 6-7 minutes left in this chapter. You know, I wonder what's going to happen. But then it comes up to a rapid close, and then I hear, like, puppies and all this, you know, all this, like...
This week in the Ellendale News.
Yes, exactly.
And specifically on the audiobook, Michael Kramer really, like, leans into it and gets into, like, all 1920s radio talk show host voice. He's like, yes, and next week when we get into the next chapter of this story, like, he really plays it up.
Yeah.
All right. Right before we get robbed on the train, Steris has had more page time in this book so far than the last two books combined, and that's not hard to beat.
Easy.
Yeah. So we've gotten some actual like tender character moments from Steris, where Wax is at least is acknowledging some genuine emotion, genuine connectability between the two of them. What do you guys think about Steris?
I think this has been wonderful. I think it's been great. It's what I've been hoping for with Steris. One, just getting to see more of her. If she's potentially marrying our protagonist, I think we just need to know at least who she is, you know, really. We get a very early picture of her just as very rigid, planned, but not very emotional individual. And I feel like we're starting to uproot that interpretation and starting to see more of, you know, just more personable Steris, I guess. I've personally just enjoyed it a lot. I think it's been really nice getting her perspective, getting more scenes with her. You're absolutely right that we've definitely over-doubled our Steris content, because there was really nothing before this. But all in all, I've really enjoyed it. I feel like we get a nice, just nice show. It's just nice to actually see Steris on page, start to actually get to know her, because she's been a player since the beginning, but just we know nothing about her until now.
I'm enjoying more screen time with Steris as well, and she's growing on me quite a bit. I actually think that I like her character now that we've gotten to see more dialogue with her. I think especially coming out of the end of last book, that was a really powerful scene that I think it's the closing lines of last book, yep, where Wax finally breaks down and is just sobbing on Steris' shoulder. You know, that's our tough hero that never breaks and shows emotion. He's always shouldering the burden. That was kind of the moment where he had to, you know, lean on someone else in a time where he's just broken it. And everybody needs that, right? And from the beginning of this book, Steris has been really supportive of Wax. Even through the whole wedding thing, she's like, hey, if you're not ready for this, we don't have to do this. You know, she's very ready to help Wax out in any way that she can. And I really like that. And she's still the really awkward and stiff and overplans everything. I'm a bit of a planner. I'm nothing in the ballpark of Steris. She is ridiculous about the details and the OCD. Like, I don't actually know much about like clinically diagnosed OCD, but maybe Steris is in that kind of category.
Could very well be. I have to say, Elliot, I agree that I also have really liked Steris. I feel like I'm kind of on her side. And yeah, I just like that we've gotten to see her a bit more personalized, I guess. Maybe I'm just ringing that, you know, over and over, saying that too many times. But I've really enjoyed it. And Wax makes a point to mention, right, whenever Lessie died originally, everyone was, I guess kind of bothering him, you know, like going too much about, I hope you're okay, I hope everything's all right, you know, I guess just being a little too over the top, trying to help him, trying to support him. And she was just there, just kind of a presence, a shoulder to cry on type of thing. And he's saying that that's what he needed. And I think that was really just important bonding moment, and probably the moment I could point to is like, okay, I can definitely see this becoming a fruitful, genuine relationship, not just this, you know, political advantage, you know?
Totally. And Steris does something absolutely hilarious, by the way, I think it's in the midst of some of the action, or kind of after the action starts, but you got some cool, sweeter relationship scenes in the earlier chapters. But then in the midst of action, Wax runs out of metals. I don't remember if this is after the
cube. It's after it gets drained from him. He has plenty, but all of it's sucked out of him.
All his metal, well, his steel that he's got, right? Because he's not Mistborn. He's got one allomantic power. Gets his steel drained, goes back to Steris, and Steris is, Aridin has thought of everything, of course. So, of course, she has backup metals for Wax. So she whips out a vial, hands it to Wax. He downs it and goes, what the heck was that? Because, remember, Wax always suspends his metal in whiskey, which is a great little, like, Wild West touch spin on allomantic vials. And he downs it from Steris, and he's like, what is that? And Steris says, oh, it's cod liver oil. You really need to be more healthy, you know. So I've replaced all of your whiskey vials with cod liver oil, and please make sure you take them regularly. It's like, oh, man, I can just picture the scene there, and it was one of the funnier moments in these books so far.
One of the first internal dialogue scenes we get from Wax in The Alloy of Law is him suspending his steel flakes in whiskey, and he says, you didn't need to, or most Allomancers didn't suspend their steel in whiskey, and most Allomancers were missing out on a perfect opportunity. To have him filled with cod liver oil is, I agree, it was a really funny touch. Steris also fires the custom made shotgun to save Wax's life, and gets like immediately rocketed off the train. You want to give us a little rocket engineering explanation on that one, Elliot?
There was almost enough here for me to revisit my rocket shotgun diagram that I did before. I'm waiting to see if we get a little more. I'm still waiting a little bit for a few answers to revisit that on the reducing your mass versus reducing your weight kind of thing. But they do get into some really interesting details here on the physics involved here of the gun is made to have a ridiculous kick and push a ridiculously huge projectile because Wax can increase his weight to withstand such a recoil and shoot like a cannonball, almost like, we're not maybe quite that size, but closer to a cannonball than a bullet into, you know, Koloss or Mistborn, Twinborn, whatever you're trying to take down, hemallergic creature, you can fire the hand cannon But only Wax can fire the hand cannon.
And does and fails to tell his betrothed that. Yeah, the I believe the casings of those of that hand cannon are described as like the width of some of a man's wrist, because he ends up firing those the shells of that gun into like one of the bandits' foreheads or something. So yeah, that's quite literally a hand cannon. And for whatever reason, I'm picturing that as a dual shot, like it's shooting two of them, but I don't know if that's actually explicitly said or not. I don't think that is true.
What I thought was amusing about this, specifically with Stair shooting it was kind of the build-up. You're introduced to this gun of like, yep, this is going to be perfect for you, specifically Wax, because you can increase your weight and just have the opportunity to shoot this super high power shotgun, like a normal person could shoot a normal shotgun, but you know, it's just a way to use his ferrochemy to his advantage, right? Which was really, really cool. And then Stairs picking it up and being like, yeah, you know, normal gun, gonna save Wax's life, absolutely yeeting herself off of the train, I thought was really funny. I thought it was neat how, you know, we're almost kind of waiting for the implication, like, or the application of this gun that we talked about, of, you know, Wax pulling it out, increasing his weight, buckling down and shooting it. And I think I thought it was really clever with that.
What on earth is wrong with that gun?
Yeah, exactly.
I will say I am not disappointed. I think we talked about this when we very first started Mistborn Era 2, because we knew we were going into a kind of the next era of technology. And I don't know if Trevor, if you asked this specifically or if we just were talking about it in general, the combinations you can get to with magic systems and technology are really fascinating. And we've been getting a lot of that. And this is more of that of, well, if you've got a magic user who can do all these things, what kind of cool technology can you design that works with that magic system? We're getting that, and I'm enjoying it.
Specifically, I think it's his revolver vindication has a safety that only he can, or that only a coin shot can flip, and it's like completely in the gun. Yeah. You would never make that in real life, but because he can push on that lever, you can make a safety that only he can fire, which I think is brilliant. Like, how would Brandon sit down and think of that? I have no idea.
I fully agree. I think that's what he's absolutely best at, is coming up with these interactions. And I don't know how you come up with them, honestly. They're incredibly clever and well thought out. And yeah, that gets me really excited. I feel like I've voiced natural apprehension toward the future generation, either modern technology eras in the Cosmere or future technology eras in the Cosmere. I guess because I didn't know how this would work. You know, it seems too complicated if, you know, when something's going wrong, instead of having to frantically sprint back to them or use Allomancy to, you know, pewter run overnight versus like giving them a call on a cell phone or something, you know?
Right.
I don't know. It feels like it gets too rocky for me whenever we get too much technology involved. But I think time and time again, as we've seen things like in this is a mild example. And then also in Yumi, I feel like is a decent example of some like modern technology being used. And Brandon Sanderson just does such a fantastic job at using it well, using it as more of an accent than than more hindering to what's going on. And so anyways, all that being said, all these little details are really making me much more excited for these other eras and other settings.
I agree. All right, what else happens during the train robbery? Oh, our cube, our steel dampening cube. The man with the cane throws a cube at Wax, and it drains his Allomancy. Do you guys remember at the beginning of Rhythm of War, Kaladin is in Hearthstone runs into this burning building to get Roshon out. And Moash kills Roshon in front of Kaladin. And there is a... I think it might actually be the Pursuer. This is the first time that he kills the Pursuer. The Pursuer has some device that drains his Stormlight.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember this?
I do now that you mention it. He's got some kind of...
It's like a Fabrial.
Yeah. Some kind of Fabrial technology. Ooh, which... That is a whole thing that I am excited to go back to now that we have read or gotten a ways into Mistborn, because I remember in a lot of the discussions with Dunvani and others about Fabrials, they talk about like the different types of metals that they're using in the Fabrials. And I remember the time just thinking, oh yeah, that's cool. But now that we've started to explore what all these metals are and what they do on Scadrial, I'm very excited to go back. Cause I don't remember what all the metals were that were used in like Risen's wheelchair and all the hover chair and stuff that she's got. I now want to go back and read and see what I can piece together on the metals. But all I recall from the scene you're depicting or you're talking about, Trevor, is that being a step down the path of like anti-Stormlight questions that we started to ask was, ooh, you can do weird things when you pair up different types of investiture on Roshar, but similarities to this cube, now that you bring it up, yes.
Right. And Rhythm of War was written after this book, but not long after. Like, I think this book, I'll actually just look it up. 2018 is my guess. Let's see if I'm right.
Well, in Lost Metal, the next one came like the year after, right? It went... Bands of Mourning, Rhythm of War, Lost Metal.
Right. So Bands of Mourning is 2016. Rhythm of War is 2020. Lost Metal is 2021. No, 21 and 22. Not 20 and 21. No, I'm right. Okay. All that to say, we get a strange cube, and they investigated it like on the last chapter of this? Chapter 9, once they're like at the station, it has a bunch of symbols that nobody can recognize, not even Milan. What's going on there? Is it off world or is it on world but somewhere not in the basin?
I feel like this has to just be one of those nods that is definitely off world. I couldn't tell you what world it's from, but... Seems to me like it definitely has to be an off-world thing. So naturally, my guess is like Elantris or something. But if the Chondra don't know about it, then I feel like it's something that's... It could be an on-world mystery, but I'm thinking that this is something else.
I think it could feasibly even be Roshar. Like, whatever they used on Kaladin, this could just be that. Just straight up.
Yes, I agree. The whole thing about like the runes, you don't know what they are and stuff, kind of reminded me of when our heroes in Roshar, what was it? Was it when they found Urethiru and there was like the room with all the like markings on the wall? It's a bit foggy, the details. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but...
The secret drawer room?
Yes, I think that's what I'm talking about.
And when Norrin unlocks it with his weird spren guy.
Yeah. That but felt also just reminiscent of that to me. But I could be wrong. I don't remember the details.
I'm not necessarily going down an off-world path just yet. Just because we've seen similar effects already on Scadrial.
Sure.
And our characters aren't too surprised by this either, because they talk about yet another source of potentially this. And what I'm referring to is in Era 1, we saw aluminum, that when an Allomancer burns aluminum, well, I guess that would be a Mistborn. When a Mistborn burns aluminum, well, maybe it doesn't. Now I'm spinning myself down all kinds of thought trails. But let me back up. When you burn aluminum, you like absorb or delete all of your other metals that you have. They do this to Vin on purpose to remove all of her metals in Air One. So we already know aluminum can kind of do that from an Allomancy standpoint. Our characters discuss this in chapter, it's either 8 or 9, and they talk about a leecher. They just go, oh, was it a leecher? And Wax says, no, it couldn't be a leecher because he didn't touch me. So the implication there being, and they mention chromium as well. Well, here it is right here. Leechers who burned chromium could blank another Allomancer's metals, but it required touch. So apparently if you burn chromium and you touch someone, you can do that whole thing where you absorb or destroy their metals. But Wax says this wasn't that. But the fact that we have other examples similar to this makes me wonder if we're just combining magic in a different way to use some of the same stuff to do it in a different way that Wax isn't expecting.
Sure. Guess we'll have to read and find out for that one. What else? Talked about the beast. We talked about this cube. The robbers themselves, Wax has a couple interesting notes that he makes. As the train is being robbed, he kind of mentions offhand, they're not wearing masks and they're riding horses. He even says, like, they've been reading too much cheap fiction. Like, nobody actually does this. Like, when you're stopping a train, you just either derail it or make it stop and you just board it. Like, nobody rides horses alongside the train and risks life and limb to jump on the train. Like, why are they doing this? What's going on? And then who seems to be their leader, the man with the cane, who is younger than Marcy is expecting in the interaction that she has with him. But then he gets like thrown off the train by the other guys before the end of the scene. So like maybe he truly does need the cane. So what is going on with our robbers and the Night Street gang, and who's the man with the cane?
So it was really funny that, you know, that Wax assumes these guys are like, either it's their first thing and they're copying a novel, or, you know, or they just don't know what's going on. But we find out later that this is allegedly like an established group, right?
Right.
And that's what has me puzzled. I'm like, yeah, it would be kind of funny, I feel like, if this is just some like newbie crime group. But this is an established group, and we're trying to figure out, I guess, who the leader is. And, I mean, as far as guesses, I have no clue. I keep waiting for, what is it, Wax's uncle or someone to get involved. But it doesn't feel like this guy fits the description. Not sure.
I thought it was going to be his uncle at first, because his uncle does have a cane. That's one of his descriptors. And so when they first said man with a cane, I was thinking, oh, it's going to be Edwarn Ladrian, and then clearly it's not. But now I'm kind of curious, is Kane like a symbol of membership to the set, and this is another member of the set? And I will admit I'm a little bit biased, or I've been led on by the cover art on my book. Okay. Because I went and bought a box set for Mistborn Era 2, and I thought it'd be fun to go buy the UK version just to have a rather unique looking set on my bookshelf. So I bought the UK version. I'm holding this up to my camera. If you're watching on YouTube, you can probably see. But if you look up the cover of the UK version of the Bands of Mourning, it's like a pillar with a man at the top clearly holding a cane, and then lower down beneath him is another man, also with a cane. It's kind of down there. So we got two men on the cover with canes. So man with cane is something I've kind of noted.
That is pretty cool, because my thought was, you know, the word on the street right now is their leader's this man with a cane, but he looks too young or something like that. I think it is still very, in fact, I would say very possible to the point of predicting outright that Edwin Ladrian is going to be the boss behind this. Whether that's actually this man or, you know, it's the other secret villain behind that guy pulling strings that we don't know about yet. I think that's more likely the scenario that we'll have. I could be wrong, but I'm kind of waiting for him to come into play. And that cover art difference, I feel like, makes a huge difference, actually, because the ones I've seen, the I guess, original ones, and I think the one Trevor has in his hands, totally different. It does not indicate
There's no cane on mine.
Yeah, no there cane.
There's wax jumping over a city with waterfalls coming down off of it.
Yeah. The audiobook cover, I think, is like the picture of what? Of wax and Steris together, Steris. I think.
Yep.
Yeah. So no canes in sight. This group feels a little bit like the Ghostbloods felt for me whenever we first were introduced to them in Stormlight. I don't know if y'all feel similarly. It's not quite the same, but it just feels like this. Oh, this is the local, you know, crime group.
By local, do you mean planetary?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's the case. It does feel like Era 2 Scadrial does probably have more just crime groups, organized crime groups like this, anyways, like gangs. So.
That is interesting that you called Ghostbloods local to Roshar.
Well, okay, whenever you like meet them, you're like, this is you know, the Ghostbloods are like, you know, the top gang, you know, around these parts, you know. Now I obviously know that it's very different, and I don't anticipate that this group is on the same scale as the Ghostbloods are. I definitely do not think that's the case. But upon, you know, being introduced to them, it felt similar to when I was introduced to the Ghostbloods, I think.
Or are they the same group?
That could very well be. These guys don't seem as... it very well could be. I'll just leave it there. Right now, I don't think so, but it could. I mean, that's very possible, I guess. Different time frames, so.
Anything else? Oh, just as an aside, Elliot, you've complained in the past about Brandon leaving out scenery and smells and feel and taste in his books, but the terrain that we get approaching New Saren, I felt like was pretty well described. Like he describes that Wax can see the robbers by starlight because there's no moon on Scadrial, and so being able to see detail via starlight, I would love to see that. And the terrain that they're going through, where there's a railroad track like winding through mountains, I finally felt that my home state of Colorado was pictured in a book. Like on the west side of Colorado, that's exactly what Colorado is old railroad tracks kind of just winding through passes and up creeks and stuff. And I finally saw it in a fantasy book.
It was very cool. And I did get the visual in my head. And I think it's actually a testament to Brandon's impressive skill at this, in that he actually still doesn't do what I'm asking for. What I'm asking for, selfishly, personal opinion, what I like to have, and I know a lot of people don't like this. Give me a whole page. Give me a whole page of just the narrator telling me what Wax is seeing. That's the kind of thing that I actually like, is I want to take a little step back from the characters and try to imagine the scene in my head. Those are the kinds of things that I ask for when I'm saying that. I still don't think Brandon does that in these chapters. But the reason why I say he's a master is because he can paint that visual picture for you without that. He doesn't stop to give you a description of the scene that Wax is seeing. He weaves it into the dialogue and the action and the bits and pieces. He gives you a little bit of just plain old description, but a lot of what you're talking about, Trevor, I think is buried in a lot of what else is going on, which is, I think, a testament to his impressive skill in that you can walk away with a clear picture of Colorado without him stopping to do that in the chapter.
Yeah, I agree. Specifically, the use of the word switchbacks, I appreciated in the book. And I think we'd be remiss to not acknowledge the Wayne and Milan scene at the end of the chapters here. We're getting a little involved while the whole action sequence was going on. What did you guys think of?
It was not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
At the end, but it was odd that Wayne seemed absent throughout. I mean, it was just funny. It was just really ridiculous and funny that at the end we find out Wayne and Milan were together. This felt akin to it's just a bit odd whenever it's like, as far as we know, a normal guy and some kind of mystical being like the Chondra that's thousands of years old or whatever. And then I remember Shrek and in Shrek 3 or whatever, donkey and a dragon having kids, and I'm like, well, you know, anything can happen, I guess, in stories that people write to come up with. So I never really know what to think. But all in all, it was just comical. I think this is just classic Wayne comic relief, just really ridiculous. I laughed out loud. I think whatever, just the dialogue of it was really ridiculous. It was just a big mess.
I was not mentally prepared for a Wayne sex scene. I gotta say that. When I flipped the page, it was oh, all right. I agree with you, Paul. I think it was comical, and Wayne is, maybe we're just getting to know Wayne better. But he, this and the whole water tower at the wedding from last time, Wayne. Wayne is really like pushing the boundaries. He's really kind of going out there, and we're seeing new sides of Wayne that we haven't seen before. And it's adding a very interesting dynamic to our team, and that Wayne, who used to just be the comic relief, and maybe this is all supposed to still be just the comic relief, is now kind of do we know this guy? Like, I don't know if I know this guy.
Yeah. Anything else, gentlemen?
That's all I got. I'm very excited to get to New Saran and find out what is waiting for us there.
Sounds good. Let's do a quick Stormlight review, and then we will close the chapter or the episode. It is still 10-6. We tied last week. Paul, this goes to you. I'm going to give you a chapter name. Give me a brief summary of what happens in the chapter. Always with you.
I think this is the chapter where Kaladin refreshes or rejuvenates or kind of heals his bond with Syl. There's like the point where they have their bond kind of weakens in the middle of the story, and I think this is the chapter that is brought back, except now I'm remembering what that chapter is, and I think I'm wrong, but I'll stick with it. I'll just say that's the case.
Incorrect.
Okay.
Elliot, always with you.
I was going to go down the road that Paul just did, but I think I'm skewed by the fact of that's like where I am right now in the story with my review of of Stormlight as I'm trying to prep for Stormlight 5 later this year. So I'm like at that moment in Words of Radiance right now, which is why it first jumped into my head. I'm going to go a different direction and say this has to do with, I don't think this is right, but the best I got, Adolin and Maya. Again, with the like Spren and human thing, but this is a later Adolin and Maya chapter after he's learned kind of that she's more responsive than they thought. They're probably in Shadesmar, like going to the city, and they've got Maya with them. It's not later on, like the big climactic scenes that we see with them at Lasting Integrity. Is that what it's called? It's before that.
Incorrect. This is a more sinister title than you both are leaning on.
That was my next guess, was potentially like the Thrill or Odium or something.
Yes. So Dalinar brings Jasnah and Navani into a vision in the early chapters of Oathbringer. And at the end of the vision, Jasnah and Navani return. Dalinar does not. And Odium makes his first in-person appearance to Dalinar and reveals that he is always with him, manipulating him to do what he wants.
It's like Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Sees you when you're sleeping.
Yep.
All right, Elliot, this goes to you. Your quote ID, who's talking? Old friend, honor might be dead, but I have felt something else. Something beyond. A warmth and a light. It is not that God has died. It is that the Almighty was never God.
This is Taravangian.
Incorrect. Paul?
I'm going to need my classic reread, Mr. Trevor.
Old friend, honor might be dead, but I have felt something else. Something beyond, a warmth and a light. It is not that God has died. It is that the Almighty was never God.
This has to be from Stormlight, correct? Correct. Well, all the quotes, all the stuff listed, obviously it's Stormlight. It's a really dumb question. I don't know who else would use the phrase old friend. So I'm just going to go with Dalinar.
You are correct.
Okay.
Elliot did a little overthinking over there. He is actually speaking with Kadash, his old ardent buddy, who is really upset that Dalinar has seemingly denounced the Vorin Church. His response is, "Please, Dalinar, don't ever repeat what you just said. I can explain away what happened tonight, maybe, but you don't seem to realize you're aboard a ship barely afloat in the storm." This is at the beginning of Oathbringer when his Ardents are like really not sure if they're supposed to support their High Prince or like denounce him and walk away from him, stuff like that.
And one of the keys there that I should have cut into is that whole warmth and light that he's felt. Like that's a recurring thing with Dalinar, yes. That he feels this warmth, and we're very not sure what the source of that is.
Dawnshard. All right.
Fair.
Paul, here's your review. I wish that this was my first Brandon Sanderson book rather than my fifth. I did really enjoy it, but I just can't help but compare it to his later stories. And there are times when it just felt a little short in the comparison. But that's not really fair, honestly, because this was great. Of course Sanderson's writing improves, and may it continue for the rest of time. But considering where he started, it's mighty impressive. We've got a whole world here, nay, two whole worlds. One resides within the other, much like the Vatican in Rome.
So this can be any Cosmere book, right?
Correct.
Hypothetically.
It is heavily weighted to Stormlight, but yes. Feasibly anything you have read.
Okay. And classic Paul, I'm going to ask you to read it one more time.
Sure. I wish that this was my first Brandon Sanderson book, rather than my fifth. I did really enjoy it, but I just can't help but compare it to later stories. And there are times when it just fell a little short in the comparison. But that's not really fair, honestly, because this was great. Of course Sanderson's writing improves, and may it continue for the rest of time. But considering where he started, it's mighty impressive. We've got a whole world here, nay, two whole worlds. One resides within the other, much like the Vatican in Rome.
I think this is Rhythm of War, and which was not my original thought, but I think this is Rhythm of War, and I think this is 5 out of 5.
Okay, Elliot. You're muted.
So I am. Rhythm of War is on my list too. I'm debating between it and others. But I'm gonna keep beating a dead horse that did not work for me last time, but it might this time, and say this is Elantris, because that description just seems to fit that book really well. The city within a city, world within a world. I mean, that's Elantris, right? With the Elantrian city, the world outside. He's talking about early books. I feel like this is a very common perception of Elantris, is people go back, they like to read it, but then they say, oh, it's not as good as his later works. It almost seems too obvious, like you're trying to fool me, Trevor, but I'm going to try yet again to go outside of Stormlight and say this is Elantris, and this is a 4 out of 5 rating.
This was written in March of 2012. And is a review of Elantris for 4 out of 5.
Hey.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed because I specifically ruled out Elantris because I thought he was talking about, like, oh, Sanderson's new books are so much better than the old ones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I thought this might have been Yumi. That's what I was thinking of, actually.
Okay.
With the whole two worlds thing, but then I was like, nah, yeah. This is the Roshar and Shadesmar. Wow. I'm pretty baffled.
All right. With that, Elliot takes a 2-to-1 lead going into the trivia question. Which Stormlight book has a rewritten scene after publication?
After publication?
No. Yes. If it was pre-publication, I would be asking what Stormlight book has been edited. No, what Stormlight book has a rewritten scene after publication?
Hmm. I feel like we've talked about a few different scenes and how maybe Brandon rewrote them or made changes, but all of that I had thought was all, this is the original thought that Brandon had, and he modified it before it got published. So nothing is jumping to mind for me that would fit the, like, rewritten after publication, but I think I'll just go with Oathbringer.
Incorrect. And I think Paul might have an advantage here because he's an audiobook listener.
I think I do know this. I think it's Words of Radiance. Right, that's the second book. It's the scene at the end when Kaladin and Zeth are fighting, and it's whether or not the Shardblade goes through the spine. Something related to that, whether it actually goes through the spine or not, was changed after release.
You are exactly correct. Congratulations.
I remember that now.
We talked about it on the podcast.
We did.
On audiobook, Kaladin explicitly kills Zeth with no hesitation. He just summons Syl and stabs him straight through the spine. On post-publication, about a year later, so all of the original hardbacks have that copy. All of the mass paperbacks a year later are printed with Zeth surrenders his life and cuts all of his lashings, falls back into the storm, and Kaladin, I think, like, slices his hands so the sword drops or something. But Zeth specifically, like, surrenders his own life once he's accepted the fact that the Radiants have returned and he is no longer truthless. So you are correct, Paul. You have tied it 2-2, and once again, no points for this.
I'm just baffled with the 4-5 Elantris.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. When Elliot said it, I was actually like, wow, he's really throwing this one away. You know, no way it's Elantris. I'm impressed. Wow.
Well, you're fending me off. You're holding steady.
All right. Let's reconvene next week with more Bands of Mourning. Thank you for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Onward.
Ciao.